May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice and members, my name is Jay Brim with the firm of Brim and Arnett in Austin. I'm joined at council table by David Richards with Richards, Wiseman, and Durst of Austin. I will present opening argument and Mr. Richards will close. The case under submission today is from a summary judgment granted by the trial court in a case, suit for declaratory and injunctive relief and damages. It was originally brought by a broad cross-section of professional and paraprofessional employees of the Lumberton Independent School District through a number of actions. At the time of the judgment in the case, only a group of teachers now remain as your applicant for writ of error. The original group, I represented the original group of plaintiff teachers that filed the case. Some, like Gladys Byram, who testified at the summary judgment hearing, suffered pay cuts in this action of over 10% of their salary, $2,800 in her case. We brought 3 points of appeal, as I'm sure you're aware. The first two concerned whether the school district could, under the contract between the parties, unilaterally change the salary scale after school had started. I don't want to bore this court with mundane additional facts, but I'm sure you're aware that there are 1,060 school districts in the state and over 200,000 professional personnel, as we pointed out in our supplemental brief. I don't want to mislead the court with those numbers. 185,000 of that estimated are teachers, but of that number, under the two different types of contract systems we have for teachers in this state, the education agency estimates that approximately 45% of the teachers have continuing contracts. This court, of course, doesn't get to hear many education cases. The Grounds case decided 2 years ago by this court had to do with the other type of contracts, term contracts, which are generally controlled by Chapter 21 of the Education Code, the Term Contract Non-Renewal Act. This case has to do with continuing contracts, which are controlled by Chapter 13 of the code and are what we call a tenure system in this state insofar as we have it. Chapter 13 provides for an annual expectation of renewal of the contract for the teacher if no notice otherwise is given to the teacher in the spring of the year. Typically, as was done in this case, the school district sends out some form that seeks to discern whether or not there is an intent to return the coming school year. And the marshal has distributed to the court a copy of an exhibit that you've seen a number of times in the brief submitted by the party. It's entitled The Supplement to Continuing Contract Agreement. Supplement to continuing contract agreement.
Apparently some of us got them and some didn't.
Generally speaking, in a continuing contract district, a teacher will sign the initial continuing contract agreement with the district and then after that only receive one of these supplements during each school year in the spring to determine whether or not they're going to be reemployed in the coming school year. This particular form, you will note, says that you're notified your salary of the school year 85-86 beginning on the 26th day of August 1985, which was the first day of in-service in that school year, will be the state of Texas minimum foundation salary plus local increment. This is the essence of the case. That's the notice that the district gave to the school teacher, to each of these teachers, what their salary would be. And that's the only notice that was given until the school board finally made a decision after the opening of school later that fall. You'll note that the teacher has to respond within 30 days. And if the teacher doesn't respond to this notice sent out, then the teacher has elected to resign his or her continuing contract status with the district and no longer has a contract under this system. The paragraph at the bottom there sets that out. Failure of the teacher to accept this agreement within 30 days shall be considered a refusal on the part of the teacher to accept the continuing contract status. Now, frankly, that is a paragraph that comes from the continuing contract law in Chapter 13 and is supposed to only be sent the first time, the first year, that a teacher moves from probationary status to continuing contract status. But in this particular situation, this particular school district, they seem to send this same supplement on every school year and did so this year. The teacher then accepts that offer, late March to late April, and says, I'm going to come back. However, until August 1st, under the system as it's normally followed throughout the state, the teacher's got the opportunity to go out and look for a better job and can resign without penalty, and the district must accept the resignation. The teacher must, after that date, after August 1st, must receive the permission of the school board to resign if he or she wishes to leave the employment of the district. And if they attempt to leave the employment of the district without receiving that permission, they lose the right to teach for that school year automatically. And that's under Texas Education Code 13.116. The first week of August really is the last real opportunity for a teacher to get employment in the state. By the middle of August, no personnel director in the state wants to have any openings on their staff. They need to have the teachers in place and ready to come to the in-service training and begin teaching the kids on the first day of September. So in truth, if you don't make that decision by the 1st of August, your opportunities of finding other employment rapidly diminish.
Is that part of the summer judgment evidence, what you just stated?
Yes, sir. All that is part of...
And whose affidavit is that appear?
Well, the discussion came in the depositions that were taken. And I'm sorry, I'm not able to immediately call it forth, but we did have the deposition testimony of the superintendent.
While we're on the subject of that, reading over particularly respondent's brief, they cite deposition page so-and-so. How are these depositions handled? Were they all introduced into evidence at the time of the hearing or what? Was the court asked to consider them? I mean, are they...
Judge, my best recollection was they were referred to in the summary judgment evidence. They were filed with the court, is my recollection. Perhaps the respondent may want to address that. The first day of in-service, as I mentioned, was August 26, 1985.
Well, let me add, before you go on, is either side contesting the deposition that are not before us?
No, sir.
Okay.
No, sir. On August 26, 1985, the teachers began teaching, and that same night, the board readopted the budget for the previous school year, for the 1985-86 school year. I want to be frank with the court about what it was they readopted. There are a number of different types of budget forms that the school boards adopt, and the one that the board adopted in this case was a summary form that's used to report to the Texas Education Agency what their expenditures will be for the coming year. And it was, in essence, a total budget that would be expended with very little itemization within it. But it was the same budget for the 84-85 school year, and this was the only, at that point, the only action taken by the board to indicate what it would spend on salaries for the coming school year. A number of meetings took place between then and September 16th, as is detailed for you in the various briefs. There was a great deal of controversy on the board and within the community about what money would be spent. This was the second year following the adoption of House Bill 72. House Bill 72 had funded increases for the teachers that were mandated to be passed on to them. And there had been some controversy on this board and within the community about the passage of these salary increases onto the teachers. However, on August 26th, the board did go ahead and take the position that it was going to follow the same budgetary path that had followed the previous school year. It's worthy to note that on September 16th, when the board did finally take its action adopting a salary schedule for the teachers, that it was amending the budget that it had already adopted. Now, the two points of appeal we brought to you really boil down to just a breach of contract argument. although they're from two different directions. Since the court has already acted on application for writ of error in a continuing contract case out of the Houston Court of Appeals, I'd rather take the other point first, the contract point. And looking at point number two, our position is that the written agreement between the parties, as you're looking at it before you, was not a contract. That this supplement was deficient in that it failed to specify, make definite, a material item in the contract, the most material item from the point of view of these plaintiffs, and that being the salary. And that without that definiteness, that this could not be considered a contract. And we've researched the common law of contracts, and the first statement of contracts, section 32, an offer must be so definite in its terms or require such definite terms in the acceptance that the promises and performances to be rendered by each party are reasonably certain. There's no way to determine from the supplement before you what the contract to pay is. It was left open. The first statement goes on to say, a statement by A that he will pay B what A chooses is no promise. There are specific examples. A promises B to do a specified piece of work, and B promises A to pay a price to be thereafter mutually agreed. As the only method of settling the price is dependent on future agreement of the parties, and as either party may refuse to agree, there is no contract. Our point is that the school district took the position in this situation that it had the absolute right to set the pay level at which these teachers would be paid at whatever time it finally determined that it would act. We don't think that's fair. We think that under the common law contract, as stated in the first restatement, and as a matter of fact in the second restatement of contracts, certainty of choice of terms are also included.
That is there your problem the plus local increment, or is it the state of Texas minimum foundation salary?
It's the local increment, Mr. Chief Justice. The problem we
So this said we're going to pay you the state of Texas minimum foundation salary, period. She signed it, it would be a binding contract.
That's right, it would
but
be a definite.
In fact, they promised some more.
Yes, sir, they did. And that's our concern.
I can't remember now. Did they pay no increment, no local increment, or did they pay only a partial local increment?
They paid a local increment, and they changed it. That's our concern, that they went from one type of salary schedule that paid irregular increments based on years of experience to another type of salary schedule that paid regular increments based on years of experience. And as a result, some teachers actually received a raise in the change on September 16th. While many others received reductions in pay. And the overall effect was to reduce the total amount expended for salaries that school year. There are several possibilities. First, what we assert is that at least on August 26th, there had to be a definite contract between the parties. There's a provision of the law. It says there has to be a written contract between this school district and the teacher and in order for the teacher to perform as a teacher in the school district under the continuing contract system that the district was following. That's 13.101. So if there had to be a contract between the parties, on the day the teacher began work at least, that teacher must have had a contract we could construe, either by agreement or by construction. There had to have been a contract on that day. So on August 26th, when the teachers went to work, they had to have a contract. The contract that is before you was not complete. And what we've come to the court for is a construction of this contract. We see several possibilities. You could construe that they be paid at least the minimum salary listed in that section. But Mr. Chief Justice, as you've already pointed out, they promised a local increment in addition to that in the supplement. Second construction could be that the district, and this is what the district has said, and that is that they could decide to pay whatever salary they decided to pay whenever they finally issued the checks. But again, that wouldn't meet the problem of definiteness of this term. The third option, and that's the one that we have relied on throughout this the course of this litigation, that is that the most recent increment paid to that employee is what that employee is entitled to assume is in place. And we're relying in part on the fact that the board went back and readopted its prior year budget. Now, the respondents have pointed out to you in their brief, and I'm sure they'll tell you again today, that the previous school year, during all this controversy over House Bill 72 and adopting the new salaries, the board had said, we're only going to adopt this set of increments for 1 year. And they've given notice to the world that that's what they intended to do in 84-85. Our problem arises when they waited past the beginning of the school year in 85-86 to take any further action. And the only action they did take readopted that same budget.
If they'd done this on July 29th, would you be here?
I don't think so. No, sir. No, our problem is entirely with the timing. Our other argument, of course, is it goes to the tenure law and what effect the tenure law has on terms of the contract. As I mentioned earlier, you've already acted on one application concerning this involving a number of days set out in a contract. There's a distinction between that problem and ours in that there was a definite number of days in that contract. And we have here an indefinite term of this contract that we're seeking construction from this court, But we think that still we must look to the tenure application of this law and that these teachers had a right to the very same security interests that the court in Houston was speaking to in interpreting the tenure system. The courts we are coming from below refused to recognize the continuing contract law as a tenure system. We felt it necessary to raise this point with you and reaffirm, as this court has in the past, that this is a tenure system. The teacher commits in the spring by signing this supplement and saying, I'm going to come back in the fall. On August 1st, the teacher's locked in and cannot leave.
That disturbs me, that the teacher cannot leave.
Yes, sir.
Do you attack this statute?
No, sir. I think on an individual basis, it can be fairly interpreted so long as the teacher makes a knowing choice on August 1st to stay. And that's our problem here, that on August 1st, if they don't know what they're going to be paid, they're not making a knowing choice. And we have a great deal of difficulty with that.
Well, they can leave. I mean, there's no suit for damages. They just can't.
That's right. That's right.
A teacher in the middle of the school year can just shut the book and walk out, and there's no, the school district can't sue them for damages.
No, but what they can do is remove their certificate,
Okay.
Which is a far more significant penalty for the teacher. They can go to work someplace else.
Can they remove their certificate after August, between August 1 and August 25th?
Yes, sir. Anytime after August 1st.
Do that, or?
I'm sorry?
They apply to the state to remove that certificate?
Under the system, under 13.116.
And I process rights or anything?
No, there is. It is, we of course argue that there is always the opportunity for the teacher to come forward and argue the facts, but if the facts are established, that the commissioner must suspend them for 1 year. Under subsection C of 13.116, a teacher holding a continuing contract obligating the employing district to employ such person for the ensuing school year who fails to resign within the time and in the manner allowed under previous subsections of this section and who fails to perform such contract shall be ineligible for employment by any other Texas school district during the ensuing school year covered by such contract, and his teaching certificate shall be suspended for that school year only. We have due process to determine the facts, but once the facts are determined, there's no choice there. You're suspended for a year.
That's a second-class citizen.
We've got some adhesion here that forces these teachers to stay in one place and wait and see what they will be paid. And that's the essence of why this lawsuit is before the court. There are some other concerns that have been raised by the respondents.
Before you go in, you keep talking about that Houston case as if we've taken it. Didn't we deny that?
Yes, sir. And it went the other way. It went for the teacher.
I understand. They said you couldn't have a unilateral alteration of a continuing contract.
Yes, sir. And that's essentially where we're coming from. The only distinction being there was a specific term that was messed with in that contract.
Only thing I wanted to bring out, I thought you had said something to the effect that we had taken the case, but we written denied the case.
Yes, sir.
Okay. It was not the same as an NRA.
No, sir. Although I'm sure there'll be many comments written on that particular point in the next few years.
One more question that you point out, this is a 1 year,
school district maintains the one-year deal, special deal in mind with the education reform. How much of a raise did the teachers get in the 84-85 year over what they had in the 83-84?
Well, there was a mandated raise under the House Bill 72 salary schedule that was brought in that averaged somewhere around $1,800 per teacher. And it was mandated that the school district pass that on.
Somewhere less than a 10% raise, right?
Well, depending on, in some cases, that was 15% or more. Teachers weren't paid very much and still aren't paid very much. One of the main objectives of House Bill 72 was to increase the level of compensation across the board, and especially in the earlier years for teachers. And there are some other aspects.
Are they getting more than $300 a month now, which is what was paid in the United States?
Yes, sir. Even after the actions of the school board, they're still getting more than $300 a month. But
whether they're worth it or not, like he was.
Our arguments to the two different points, we hope, dovetail together for you. In essence, they're both breach of contract cases and just different viewpoints on the same problem, and that is that the district ought to tell the teacher before the teacher is obligated to perform what the teacher's going to make.
Was there any impossibility involved in this, like the tax roll wasn't certified or didn't know the income?
Well, of course, respondent may differ.
It's more to respond, but I'm just
well, differ with my characterization. But no, sir, it was just an ongoing local political controversy. There was some dispute between the sitting superintendent and the board. They later terminated the superintendent, made a change in leadership. That have something to do with it.
What was the average reduction that was taken by the teachers?
Well, they reduced overall $150,000 on 263 employees. But there were some pay increases in that and some pay reductions. There are some exhibits that break it out, but right offhand, I don't think I could throw that to you. We, of course, pointed out to you the worst ones. And there were less than a dozen of those that had that worst case scenario. A number of others that had four-figure reductions.
Which one is your client, Mrs. Bowman?
I have a large number of clients in this.
Several,
Justice Culbert is. She's the first alphabetically.
And what was the reduction on the ones that you're representing?
It differed from one to the other. Ms. Bynum is one of our plaintiffs. She had 2,800. I think there were those who were left at the same level, but none of them are now plaintiffs. I believe the least was $130-some-odd reduction
total
over an annual salary.
Thank you.
While you're on the subject, why don't you explain for the court's benefit the distinction between the plaintiffs and the interveners in this case?
In this case, I represented 10 teachers who initially filed the lawsuit, along with a second group of administrators. My group was primarily from one group association, the Association of Texas Professional Educators, plus some other unattached teachers. The second group were principals who were suing. Very shortly thereafter, a second group intervened, primarily from the Texas State Teachers Association, a group of teachers, and a second group intervened that were not contract employees. The principals all settled their dispute. A number of, all of the non-contract employees settled theirs. This is, for the most part, the total of the teachers and who were both plaintiffs and plaintiffs.
Do we have any probationary employees before us now?
Yes, sir. But we see no difference in the way they should be treated.
You're contending that the same rule would apply to contract employees as to probationary employees.
The only real distinction in the act is the April 1 date by which probationary employees should be given notice of the change in their status if they're not going to be reemployed. And all of these teachers were given notice they'd be reemployed for the coming school year. Once that date passed, we see them as having the same rights.
What are you asking?
We would ask you to reverse and render in our favor, stating that the teachers have...
Are there any fact issues?
No, sir. I guess that's the relevant answer to Justice Kilgarland's question about whether we're contesting any of the proof put before the court. At
I take it you had a motion for summary judgment on the file there?
There were numerous cross motions for summary judgment from all parties. In our case, of course, it was partial summary judgment because we wanted to go back and seek damages from the court. We also were seeking attorney fees, and I should touch briefly on that point for you.
Well, then in any event, if we rule with you, we'd have to remand.
Yes, sir. Must be remanded for damages. Also, I've raised the point of attorney fees. Although this is a declaratory judgment action, and I don't really think it ought to even be in controversy as to whether or not we should be able to recover attorney fees, I'm raising it because, almost in response to my opponents, I believe the Gates case, Gates versus City of Dallas, is... I believe it should cover school districts, and I think you'll find that many in the school law area seem to think school districts are different from other political subdivisions when you get outside their little statutory area. We believe in this case school districts are just like other political subdivisions when they're outside their very specific function. And we think attracting the best teachers back into the district benefits those within that school district. Therefore, the local increment ought to be considered a proprietary action on the part of that school district.
Well, there's a provision for attorney fees and declaratory judgment action.
Yes, sir. There certainly is. And that's the reason I'm arguing it in the fashion I am. I'm raising this only as an additional point because it was argued at the local level and the judge decided it that way. Thank you very much for the opportunity to argue.
Thank you, counsel. We are again more. There's no more argument from petition.
You can do rebuttal.
We're now ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Hambright will present argument for respondent.
Counsel, do you believe that the Gates was all incompetent?
I think that the Gates rationale does not apply to a school district, as we cite in our brief. I'm unaware, and the court, in a case we've cited, is unaware of any case in the history of the state where it has been held that a school district acted in a proprietary capacity. So I would urge the court not to extend the Gates case, which involved a municipal corporation and a different statute, into the area of school districts.
I can't remember in that polygraph testing case that we decided not too long ago, was there that would involve the state of Texas. Were there attorney's fees awarded under the declaratory judgment?
Yes, there were. Under Section 104.
But to reach the attorney's fee question or the due process question, the court is going to have to conclude that by statute or by contract, these plaintiffs had a legitimate claim of entitlement to be paid the same increment in 85-86 that they were in 84 and 85. Briefly, to set the record straight, there's been a lot of discussion about the teachers leaving after a certain date and how they forfeit their teacher certificate. Under the statute 13.116B, a teacher may leave with the mutual agreement of the school district, and in that event, the same penalties and forfeiture issues would not apply. There's nothing in this record to suggest that any of these plaintiffs so applied or were denied permission to resign. Judge Burgess in the Court of Appeals stated that the result of this case places teachers on the horns of a dilemma. I would suggest that under the present situation, assuming that is correct, that teachers are not the only parties on the horns of a dilemma. First, you have the taxpayers and the voters who put the board in office. And when this case arose, as the court knows, Southeast Texas was suffering from a recession. There was high unemployment. There was considerable resistance to tax increases. Taxpayers were calling for tax relief. All of this appears in the depositions. So these parties were on the horns of a dilemma. If the plaintiff's argument were to prevail, then these local taxpayers and voters would be compelled to pay a tax rate necessary to fund what plaintiffs admit is a discretionary increment. So the taxpayers were on the horns of the dilemma. The members of the board were on the horns of the dilemma. They had to deal with their constituents as well as the employees to reach the best balance and accommodation of these competing interests that could be done in their judgment. The record shows that the board president was the vice president of a local savings and loan. The other board members were an office supervisor from Mutual of New York, a salesman for a drug company, an operator of a daycare center, the president of Quality Sales Company, the owner of a universal switchgear business, and a head coach at a middle school. The record also shows that these people at night, outside of their regular jobs, conducted 10 to 12 meetings throughout July, August, and September, trying to rationalize these competing issues and trying to come up with the best compromise they could strike. The issue in this case is not bad faith on the part of this board. As one of the plaintiff's attorneys stated at that deposition, I'm not saying at all that I think you acted in bad faith. I think just the opposite. And I don't think your dilemma is any different from that of 7,000 other board members in this state. Each year, the boards have to meet, and each year they face issues such as changes in student population, changes in property valuation, changes in funding from Austin, and in our case, a severely depressed local economy, high unemployment. All these factors have to go into the decision of where to set the tax rate, where to establish a salary schedule. The statutes in question and the contracts in question, in our position, expressly give the board discretion at the local level to set local increments. The mandatory state base set in the judgment of the state legislators is constant, it's fixed, it's enforceable from year to year. But under the statutes and these contracts, the flexibility of local boards to touch the pulse of the local community is left undisturbed. The Court of Appeals, Judge Dyes, wrote, "So we see that Texas really has no tenure law as some states do," citing the Settle case from Kentucky. Obviously, in the opinion, just a few paragraphs up, he cites a law review article, I believe from Baylor, where the authors discussed that Texas does have a tenure system with respect to employment, not incidents, each incident of employment, but employment. So what the court should have said and probably meant was, so we see that Texas really has no salary tenure law as some states do. The Settle case already discussed, which arose in Kentucky, shows that in that state, by statute, before the end of the school year, the board must notify its teachers of its best estimate of what their salary will be for the following year. This allows the teacher to analyze for themselves their options over the summer. For whatever reason, Texas has no statute like that. In the Hitchcock case discussed earlier today, or the Diane James case, that a pivotal point of that decision was a case from Minnesota, the Rochester case cited on page 705 of the James opinion. In Minnesota, by statute, continuing contracts can only be modified, quote, with mutual consent. It goes on in a footnote, footnote one of that opinion, that said to say that unilateral modifications can only be made in certain narrow circumstances. In Texas, we have no such statute. In earlier proceedings in the case in the trial court, another case was mentioned, the Needleman case, 602 Fed Second, page 1, arising in the First Circuit in 1979. That case concerned a Massachusetts statute. In footnote 1 of that opinion, the statute is set forth at length. A teacher may only be demoted for such things as inefficiency, incapacity, unbecoming conduct, insubordination, or other good cause. Demotion is defined in that statute to include reduction in salary. Again, the differences between these statutes from other states and the Texas statutes is dramatic. The system in Texas is fair, it permits flexibility, but at the same time, it offers teachers assurances that in no event will they be paid less than state base.
Council, those other states have collective bargaining for teachers?
The Minnesota case involved collective bargaining. I'm uncertain of the others.
Do they have local implements in the other states, other cases? Are they all state employees?
I don't have that information.
I think Texas is in the minority with that.
There never has been bargaining over salary in Lumberton. To accept the plaintiff's position would violate a couple of important principles of law. Under the statute, the trustees have the exclusive power to manage and govern the schools. To require that once a discretionary increment is set, it may never be reduced, would interfere with that exclusive power to manage and govern the school. Further, under the cases, it is against public policy to purport to bind public officials to exercise their discretion in the future in a particular manner. That aspect of the plaintiff's argument is also infirm.
Now, is that what the plaintiff is arguing, or are they rather arguing that you have to do it by August 1st?
Nothing in the statutes imposes that limitation.
You were telling us what the plaintiff's argument was. And I want to get it clear, because I understood them to say that you did have that local discretion if you exercised it prior to August 1st.
That appears to be their position today in oral argument. I don't see where there is a magic date by which a salary schedule must be adopted, either in the statutes or in the contracts.
So is your position that the local board can exercise its discretion at any time during the contract year to reduce the benefits payable to the individual employee?
Under present law, that's correct.
If the teacher doesn't like it, the school district doesn't agree, that teacher cannot get another job teaching during that year.
Under present law, I believe that is the case, Your Honor.
Would that be a retroactive reduction?
I think
they say in December that retroactively, for the whole year, you're not going to get the increment you thought you were.
I think, Your Honor, if the district acted to set a salary schedule, then the district would be bound by that salary schedule until it were changed by the board pursuant to notice and hearing under the Open Meetings Act. There's a case that was mentioned in some of the earlier pleadings in the trial court where a district tried to go back and collect what it perceived were overpayments in earlier days by offsetting current salaries, and the court there held that that was improper. So I don't think the district could act and then retroactively cut. They could cut and then from the adoption of the salary schedule forward continue the new rate under current law without bargaining or without restriction.
On what date did the district decide to change the method of paying local increments?
This was considered in late summer. The final 1985-86 salary schedule was adopted on September 16, 1985.
Were teachers paid, they went to work on August 26th. Did they, or I guess some of them, elect to have their salaries on a 12-month basis as opposed to a 9-month. It used to be. I don't know if it still is.
That's right, Your Honor. Some of the teachers, it is my understanding, although I'm not sure it's in the summary judgment proof, were paid on August 30th for work in the prior year, and then their first paycheck for the 85-86 school year was not until September 30th, because the district generally, in most cases, pays at the end of the month.
But August 30th would encompass some period for 5 days between August 26th and August 31. What pay would the end of August check have reflected?
That would
prior
be
increment or the one that went into effect in September?
That would have been the prior increment, because that would have been their last month of that year.
Okay.
Before leaving the statutes and quickly going into the contract area, this new theory raised last week for the first time by either group of these plaintiffs that the adoption of the expenditure portion of the 84-85 school year budget somehow has any impact on this case is infirm. First, I received that surprise brief on Saturday. I took a specialization exam on Monday. I've been unable to respond to that in writing. I would point out that that argument has not been raised in any prior pleadings by these plaintiffs. The theory raised in that brief contradicts statements made by both groups of plaintiffs in the Court of Appeals. This would be page 2 and page 10 of the plaintiff's intervenor's brief, page 3 and page 6 of the plaintiff's brief. Page 3, it was said that appellants began the school year on August 26, 1985. At that time, the Board of Trustees had not yet agreed on a budget. On September 16, 1985, the Board finally adopted a salary schedule that changed the increment structure. It will have to suffice for my written response to this new theory to refer the court to page 4 of defendant's motion for summary judgment, where I addressed the interplay of the budgetary statutes, and also page 3 of defendant's response to first amended motion for partial summary judgment of plaintiffs Sue Horn, John Van Passion, et al., dated March 6, 1986. In essence, under the cases, including U.S. Supreme Court authority, these budgetary statutes did not form part of individual employment contracts. The expenditure portion of the old budget was adopted as an expedient measure on the advice of the superintendent, and that advice was wrong. All of the budget statutes are silent on the adoption of salary schedules as opposed to budgets. They impose no time limits on adoption of salary schedules, and they do not purport to give employees any rights to particular compensation levels. In fact, the 84-85 budget was attached as Exhibit 29 to the deposition of Dr. Philip Allen, the superintendent. It's 2 pages, and there aren't salary schedules anywhere on it. In fact, under the minutes of that meeting, while this expenditure portion, this line item for total salaries, was adopted because of the superintendent's advice that this had to be done by a certain length of time, the minutes of that meeting reflect that that was a 3-hour-and-15-minute meeting, and salary schedules and cuts and elimination of past errors were discussed immediately after this document. Again, as shown in Dr. Allen's deposition, 3 days later, the board acted to adopt a amended budget having descending salary cuts, trying to make up a shortfall. That meeting 3 days later lasted from 7 p.m. to 2:01 a.m. These business people out there in their meeting till 2:01 a.m. There was another meeting on September 5th, and then finally the salary schedule itself was adopted on September 16th. Now, you have before you, turning to the contract issue, you have before you a supplement to continuing contract agreement. And this has been called a contract by the plaintiff. As the name implies, this is a supplement to a continuing contract. This is not a contract. It contains no job duties. It contains no number of days that the teacher will work, which is required by statute. This is a supplement. It can't be read in isolation. in an appendix to the surprise brief, the contract itself, the underlying continuing contract, is set forth. There, the language is, the district agrees to pay the teacher for all the services rendered under this contract a salary at the annual rate as fixed by the schedule of teachers' salaries as adopted by the Board of Trustees, in no event less than the state of Texas minimum foundation salary. Further, in our brief, in response to the application for writ of error, we cite authority holding that operational policies of the board, which are adopted by the board, become part of the employee's employment contract. In those operational policies, which are set out in our brief, it is provided that the teachers will be paid minimum state base plus local increment, if any. So I think you can't read this one-page document, which contains no job duties, no number of days, in isolation. It has to be read with the underlying contract and with the board policies. Under all of these documents, the board retains the same flexibility as it does under the statutes. This case is different from the Hitchcock case. In that case, the lady had a piece of paper which had an express number of days written on it. The Hitchcock opinion at page 706 turns on this concept that it talks about specific terms in a continuing contract. The Hitchcock contract was like a simple promissory note. Our